are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeter. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS and Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Thursday, January 21st, 2016. My name is Sam Steeter. This is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, a double shot, ladies and gentlemen. Let's get to know some of these candidates. One who I am concerned may be with us for quite some time. And another who I'm elated at the idea maybe leaving the national stage. First up, Andy Kroll, journalist on Ted Cruz's howitzer. Sort of a Rovian figure behind Ted Cruz. Does that come as any surprise? Meanwhile, we will also have on the program journalist Matt Katz on his new book, America's Governor, Chris Christie's Bridge to Redemption. On the update on the Bridgegate investigation and whether or not at least this guy who's been on the beat thinks that Chris Christie is just going to walk off the campaign trail and go back into the governor's house, mansion, without having to reckon with this. We will find out. Also on the program, emails released show that Snyder's administration knew there were problems with the water in Flint. Not specifically what the problems were, but they didn't seem to give a crap anyways. Meanwhile, David Koch making a quiet exit from his position on the board of directors of the Natural History Museum in New York City following activists demanding that this climate denier leave. Again, I think we mentioned this yesterday, 2015, the hottest year on record in the world. Meanwhile, some of the Republicans' big boogeymen they were hoping we're going to carry them to victory in November. New report shows that undocumented immigrant population is down to a 13-year low. And meanwhile, ISIS, not only have they lost 25% of the territory they had held as of a year ago, they are now they're cutting the salaries of their ISIS workers.
I love how they
fighters
everything.
Thugs.
They're one of the most despicable organizations on earth, obviously, and now they're doing austerity too.
Right, it's
they're just
make
trying to implement everything that's bad
exactly.
in human history.
It's like Jeb Bush's campaign over there.
It is exactly Ooh. Like Jeb Bush's campaign, and
they had a winning moment.
Right, that's true, and they still very high energy.
High energy
we will
guys,
get,
ISIS guys.
We
They're
will
high
get
energy.
To the
it's true.
To the latest in the campaign. Apparently, Carly Fiorina. I don't know if she's going to be charged with this, but it sounds like she kidnapped a bunch of fourth grade, four year olds for a campaign event that she was having. Class act, that Carly. Class act. And apparently, they still can't come around to Rubio. Bob Dole is also saying, you know, better Trump than Cruz. I gotta say, folks, I would be lying if I didn't say I was enjoying this immensely. There are moments where I think, like, oh my God, the horror of Ted Cruz being president of the United States is chilling. But I think that's unlikely. Knock on wood. I do have some news, though. I've done something that I'm feeling pretty good about. And that is, I have actually given a gift, and it's a good thing Kelly's late today, because she won't. It occurred to me that she might. Because ladies can also get this, too. Don't roll your eyes about it, Michael. But I have given to my coworkers here at Majority Report, Inc. They have each now received a Harry's razor set. That's right, from harrys.com. They both have their razor set now. With extra blades, you will note, gentlemen. Now, here's the thing. If these guys didn't know and didn't hear me do ads for Harry's once a week, they would think I spent a lot of money on them. And I don't want you to think that I got it just because it was inexpensive. I have already used my $5 off. When you get the first purchase, you get $5 off. But with that said, even though I didn't get the $5 off, $15 for a razor, a nice razor, like a chrome razor, three sets of blades, and shaving cream. And so I can go out and I can purchase two, and that's like, it's like the cost of a couple of lattes.
I'm impressed by the handle. It's like fine cutlery.
It does look nice, doesn't it? It really is nice. You guys are going to enjoy this.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
It's a great gift.
It is a great gift. It's a great gift, and it would be even a better gift if these guys didn't know how little I actually spent. but that's fine.
It's I want even a gift still, that is in thought. Keeping with your personality.
Right.
You know,
right.
It would be just disorienting if you actually
that's
spent
right.
money on something.
It's also a little bit of a hint. In other words, Michael, could be time to get rid of whatever's going on in your face.
You mean like an actual beard that I can grow as a man? Yeah, okay.
It looks a little dubious, I got to tell you. But here's the thing about Harry's. I've told you this before. There is no reason for you guys to be overpaying for a great shave. They're quality German-engineered blades, five-blade cartridges, close, comfortable shave, no cuts, no burns. Quality is guaranteed. They give you a full refund if you're not happy. These are factory-direct prices. You don't have to go into the drugstore and get one of those razors that are like shrouded in some type of like, I don't know, glass. They put it in these huge plastic things. I don't know how people actually open those things without hurting themselves. So why pay $32 for an 8-pack of blades? For $15, you get a razor, moisturizing shave cream, and three razor blades. Like I mentioned before, Harry's doesn't like the discount because the price is already low. But they will, with the promo code Majority Report, Harry's will give you $5 off your first order. Stop overpaying for a great shave. Start the new year off right. Go to harrys.com right now. That's Harry's, HARRYS.com. Enter the coupon code Majority Report at the checkout. You get $5 off your first purchase. You will not regret it. All right, folks, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, Andy Kroll on Ted Cruz's howitzer. I don't want to say this guy sounds like a bit of a sociopath, but this guy sounds like a little bit of a sociopath. We got to take a quick break. We'll be right back after this. I haven't got one anymore.
I want to see people and I want to see life. Driving in your car, oh please don't drop me home, because it's not my home, it's their home, and I'm welcome no more.
We are back. Sam Cedar on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome to the program Andy Kroll, D.C.-based journalist, has written for Rolling Stone, New Republic, Mother Jones, all sorts of publications, and has written in the New Republic about Ted Cruz's howitzer. Andy, welcome to the program.
Great to be here.
So this guy Roe, coincidentally enough, sounds very reminiscent of a Karl Rove type of figure.
I'd say that Jeff Roe, the campaign manager for Ted Cruz, is the new generation's Karl Rove, the new political Svengali of the national political stage. And in some cases, I would say Roe is even more the quintessential consultant of this era than Karl Rove was, only because Roe, the Cruz manager, has taken the sort of dark arts of politics, the ruthless campaigning, as well as the big money cash drenched politics of today, post-Citizens United, to a whole new level. So he is Roe in some ways, if not the newer version of this archetype.
You know, that's a great point. And I think that's what I found so fascinating about this story, because, I mean, this guy Roe clearly is a win-at-all-costs type of figure, but he also has got that quality of so driven by, it seems to me, enriching himself, that it really does capture that quality of what is going on in the Republican Party and in sort of the conservative movement, where there are misaligned agendas at times, misaligned incentives at times, because everybody has an angle to make a buck. And so, all right, just tell us a little bit about this guy, Roe. How did he end up becoming Ted Cruz's campaign manager?
It's a story that starts, of all places, on a hog farm in northern Missouri. This guy, Jeff Roe, was a country boy, grew up, again, in the boonies in northern Missouri, made his name in local politics, Missouri politics, really as a cutthroat, win at all costs, scorched earth. All of the descriptions in that category that you can think of have been applied to describe this guy as he is climbing the ranks in the show me state. I mean, everything from, you know, being an early practitioner of the kind of Bill O'Reilly style ambushing of opponent candidates, catch someone they're off guard, take unflattering photos of them, dig through their campaign trash, spy through the windows of their campaign headquarters. Roe had his underlings pose as volunteers or journalists to try to gather intel or catch the opposition saying something incriminating. Everything you can think of, he was doing.
And we should tell people that that's on a state Senate level, right? I mean, this is like, I think it's so apt that you say howitzer, because he's like bringing a machine gun to what, you know, I think up until fairly recently, and I think this has changed too with the amount of money that we're seeing being dumped into even the state Senate races, but he's bringing basically a howitzer into what had traditionally been a knife fight.
And a couple of points on that as well. One is, that's absolutely right. And I, you know, the comparison that a candidate who ended up on the wrong side of Roe told me was that he took a sledgehammer to a gnat.
Right.
And that, and he has this pattern in the past of, you know, again, bringing the howitzer to a campaign in which it doesn't need, he didn't need to. He, you know, these were candidates, opposition, who were underfunded, who weren't big names, we didn't have, you know, the campaign machine that Roe and his clients did, and yet he was still coming at him full bore. And the thing I would add to that as well is that this applied to Democrats and Republicans. There is no Ronald Reagan 11th commandment here. If you were a Republican in a primary running against Jeff Rowe's guy, you were getting the howitzer. And obviously, if you were a Democrat in the general election against Jeff Rowe's guy, you're getting the howitzer too.
That story of the Shettles, just tell that, because that one really sort of that I think shows the level, and particularly when he left that phone message, shows the sort of level of, I don't know, he's a little bit out of touch with what sort of general human emotions seem to be in terms of other people.
This was in 2006. Jeff Rowe's client was a congressman named Sam Graves from northern Missouri. Sam Graves, still a member of Congress. Sam Graves was the politician with whom Rowe climbed the ranks in the beginning in Missouri. Sam Graves' Democratic opponent that year is a woman named Sarah Jo Shettles, a 60-something woman in a wheelchair who really didn't have much of a political backing. And it was, you know, Sam Graves was, even though this was a Democratic year, of course, the year that the Democrats took back the House, this wasn't going to be a tough race. But in the fall of that year, of 2006, a television ad runs with a horrible photo of this woman, Sarah Jo Shettles, a Democrat, and a triple X next to her face, talking about smut, talking basically sort of, you know, comparing her almost to a pornographer in a way. And this is because years before, Sarah Jo Shettles had worked for a media company, and she had sold ads for a science magazine called Omni Magazine, now defunct, but beloved at the time. However, that same company, the flagship title there was Penthouse Magazine, which everyone will know. But this was not her job, selling ads for Penthouse Magazine. Anyway, she was selling ads for this science magazine, happened to be at the same company. And again, not making the editorial product or calling the shots, selling ads, you know, to major corporations on the business side. And then sees this ad that basically says, you know, puts triple X next to her name, and basically makes her out to be kind of a smut peddler. And then, after this ad comes out, Rowe sort of, you know, piles on, if you will, by leaving her a voicemail in which he says, you know, hi, this is Jeff Rowe calling from Penthouse. Oh, excuse me, Graves for Congress. And then when he leaves his phone number at the end, he says, tell me when you get a chance, 407 naughty girls. Oh, I mean, 122. So it was almost like a game to him. Even when the outcome of the race was more or less decided well before Election Day, he still went full bore, and it was almost sort of a game.
Let me just clarify this for people. So you've got a 63-year-old woman who is wheelchair-bound, who worked for a company that sold advertising for a science magazine, had also published Penthouse. And this guy calls her private phone, leaves a voicemail for nobody else but for her, to, I guess, taunt her with this idea that he has called her and labeled her a smut peddler. That is just, I mean, it sounds like a guy, like, now he was, presumably, he was not 14 at this time, correct? I mean, I'm assuming he was well out of his teens at this point, where I could imagine that might be even, like, remotely funny. It's just weird. And, I mean, I'm curious as to what extent. And then you go on to sort of document how this guy has an expansive business in terms of providing, I guess, public relations services for companies. And but he picks up and moves to Houston to run the Ted Cruz campaign. What is the dynamic between the two of them? I mean, how did Ted Cruz come to sort of choose this guy, or did this guy, Roe, choose Ted Cruz?
Both. Roe chose Ted Cruz well before Cruz chose Roe, but it applies to both. In Roe's case, he was on a cruise with his wife. His wife had told him, you know, you've dreamt of doing a presidential campaign. This is the pinnacle of this field that you're in, political consulting. If you're going to do this, you know, you're going to do it. You're going to go all in. You know, the family's going to pick up and move to wherever the candidate's headquarters is, and you're going to lead this thing. It's going to be your life. You know, you should pick someone who not only you think will win, but will change the direction of the country. And Roe believes that presidential elections are base elections, and that you win by turning out your people, your base, your true believers. You've got to compete for the independents, the folks in the middle, but that they are base elections. And he sized up the candidates and did his research and came to believe that Cruz was his guy. He had no connection, personal connection to Cruz. In fact, as I read at the beginning of the story, in 2012, Roe had produced one of the nastiest attacks on Cruz in Cruz's first Senate race, basically calling him unpatriotic for a case he'd been involved in as a corporate lawyer. And so, in a way, the nastiest thing that had ever been said about Ted Cruz had been said about this, had been produced in a manner produced by Jeff Roe. But, you know, Jeff Roe got in the room with him and pitched his philosophy, pitched his accomplishments. I mean, the guy, Roe, has won a lot of races around the country. People say he's tough, he's mean, but he is good. And he has built this little political kingdom of his own in this sort of post-Citizens United, sort of no-limits political era out in Kansas City, which is where he's based, typically. And Cruz obviously knew the nasty stuff. Cruz had done his research, too, and believed that this was his guy.
Well, the you wrote about one race where Roe used the sort of the classic San Francisco values, and it definitely harkened back to the New York values. Do you think that was Roe in terms of attacking Trump with those New York values?
He declined to say whether he was directly involved in that, but it has all the hallmarks. It has his fingerprints all over it, this New York values attack on Donald Trump we saw from Cruz recently. The interesting thing, and this raises lots of fascinating questions about this presidential campaign, is that this attack sort of backfired on Ted Cruz. As I write in the piece, in 2008, Roe and his candidate, Sam Graves, more or less demolished the toughest candidate that Sam Graves has ever faced with an ad basically saying she had San Francisco-style values and putting her in the same shot as Nancy Pelosi. And it was devastating and completely effective. New York values has been panned. Even Congressman Steve King, who is about as far right as you can get and is one of the top Cruz surrogates, has said, well, you know, maybe this wasn't the best approach, this New York values attack. And so it raises these interesting questions about, you know, whether, you know, Roe's influence will ultimately help Cruz as he now navigates this, you know, crazy Republican primary, or whether it'll blow up in his face in the way that New York values has in a small degree.
Well, that was the last thing I wanted to ask you. I mean, you know, as I read about this guy, he seems like a guy who has lived in the conservative bubble, you know, wakes up, reads Breitbart, wakes up, goes to Red State, whatever it is. Do you have a sense that this guy can actually communicate outside of that bubble? I mean, I think this is going to be an increasingly bigger problem for Republicans when they go. I mean, just in the same way, I mean, I guess it's just really consistent with what, you know, it's very hard for a Republican to make it through the primaries, it seems to me. I mean, I guess time will tell. Being able to speak, to sound normal to the rest of the country, you know, in other words, appealing to that base. And I wonder if, you know, just based upon, as you talk about this guy's history, he doesn't seem to have much experience in running a candidate in a place that isn't sort of already started with the sort of deep red stuff. Like, you know, the idea that, you know, it's one thing to say, you know, to spend some money and call a 63-year-old woman in a wheelchair a smut peddler and have that, you know, come to your benefit. But That type of stuff doesn't fly, I think, in a large part of the country. Do you have the sense that this guy can actually sort of make that transition?
I don't have a sense because that's not how he's made his name. I mean, he has made his name around the country working for conservative candidates, Tea Party candidates. He has worked for mainstream Republicans in the past, as I noted in the piece, but those races have been notable as much for helping mainstream Republicans shore up their conservative bona fides as much as it has been selling a mainstream message. You know, I spoke with a number of sort of Republican strategy types and former campaign managers and people like that for this piece. And, you know, they told me that it is possible to win the nomination with the base focus, almost entirely sort of trying to laser-like focus on the conservative base and say all the kinds of things far to the right you need to win those people over. It is possible to win the nomination that way. It narrows the path considerably. But the big question in for now it's just speculation is, can you ever get back to a place where you can win over the rest of the country in a general election? It's hard to see how you would if you're Ted Cruz, and you're the Republican nominee.
Mitt Romney couldn't even do it.
Mitt Romney couldn't do it. I think what you will see, though, if Ted Cruz is the nominee and Jeff Rowe is his campaign manager, and Hillary Clinton or Bernie Sanders are the Democratic nominees, Cruz is going to have his work cut out for him sliding back from the right, but they will absolutely go guns blazing against that Democratic candidate, and that is Jeff Rowe's specialty.
Right. It's going to be nasty.
And Cruz, oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, Cruz has, for the most part, remember, tried to avoid the food fight of this Republican primary. I mean, he said nice things about Trump just a couple of weeks ago, and has, you know, at the debate stage, until very recently, has tried to stay away from the sort of back and forth, bullets flying Republican primary, you know, battle royale that we've seen. But if he becomes the nominee in the general and Rowe is his guy, you will see, as they call it, contrast campaigning, negative campaigning, probably like you've never seen before.
Wow. Andy, thanks so much for your time today. Andy Kroll, the piece is at The New Republic. We will link to it. It is Ted Cruz's Howitzer. Thanks so much, Andy. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
All right, folks. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Matt Katz. He is the author of American Governor, Chris Christie's Bridge to Redemption. We'll be right back after this. We are back. Sam Cedar on the Majority Report. That replacement song, incidentally, put Alex Chilton back on the map after a while. Matt has decided to bring me back to the days of my bygone youth. On the phone, ladies and gentlemen, Matt Katz. He is a reporter for WNYC and New Jersey Public Radio, has authored and is also the proprietor of the Christie Tracker. at, or I should say, the creator of the Christie Tracker. That's at NJ.com. We'll put a link to that at Majority.fm. He's the author of the just-released American Governor, Chris Christie's Bridge to Redemption. Welcome to the program, Matt.
Thank you very much, Sam.
I got to ask you, so I want to start with the title. Bridge to Redemption? What?
You know, I had to get the bridge in there somehow, and that's right. Because of the Bridgegate scandal that enveloped Chris Christie's career, and I spent about a third of the book delving into it. It didn't destroy him, which is why it's a bridge to redemption, because he is still trying to redeem himself from that major career stumble and get his footing and try to do something here in this presidential race. So the book's coming out now, so he is on that bridge, that metaphorical bridge, not the literal one that his aides closed going into New York City.
And I mean, is it? I want to get into some of the details, but broadly speaking, I mean, is it over for him? I mean, and I'm talking about the Bridgegate investigation. I mean, is it, and the ancillary investigations? Is it broadly speaking? Is it over for him, or is that aspirational? That metaphorical bridge that he's taking.
It's somewhat aspirational. I'll quote what the U.S. Attorney of New Jersey said last May when he issued two indictments and announced a guilty plea in this case. He said,
"This is Paul Fishman." We should just
Paul Fishman, right. Exactly right. He said, "It's like Downton Abbey. You have to stay tuned to the next episode." So that was certainly enticing, but he did not charge the governor in this, and we don't. Think as of now there's any evidence to charge him. It seems that he has two other problems. One, politically, once this trial starts and once his aides get on the stand and they start talking and maybe start blaming people above them on the pay scale and the political potential for him to have to deal with the ramifications of that and maybe testify. And that would obviously be a circus. And the second issue is these ancillary problems, like you mentioned. I mean, we still believe one of his closest confidants.
All right, wait a second. Before we get to that, because I know I want to get into the Samson stuff. Let's catch people up. This sure. week, I think it is that you've got two of Chris Christie's aides. One guy who at one point has gone, at least in Chris Christie's mind, from his close friend from high school that he would create a position for in the Port Authority, to a guy he barely knew who was just sort of a hanger-on because Chris Christie was such a jock in high school. Yeah. So tell us about Wildstein and her name escapes me right now, who's also going to be on trial.
Right.
Okay, good.
Bridget Ann Kelly is the other woman. So David Wildstein went to high school with Christie. He has said that they hung out in different circles because Christie was, as you said, a jock. He was playing sports. He says he doesn't know what Wildstein was doing. One of the things Wildstein was doing was keeping score on the baseball team that Christie played for. So they certainly knew each other, and they were also in, you know, local little Republican activist type. So they knew each other from local politics when they were in high school. And then they kind of went
Hold
into
on, I want people just to marinate in that a little bit. The local Republicans in high school. I just wanted people to contemplate that notion for a sec.
There's a story out there that the governor never confirmed that Christie had his first beer on his way home from a Tom Kane for Governor rally in 1977 that was held in Trenton, Jersey. And him and Wildstein, they pulled over, got a six pack and had a couple of beers to mark their sort of initiation into Republican politics. So they go back.
And what year would that have been? I'm just trying to figure out
77,
what.
77, I believe.
So I guess they're blaring Born to Run, drinking some beers after coming back from that.
Right. Right. they went in a little bit different direction. Actually, Wilson got into politics first. He had a controversial brief stint as mayor of the hometown of Christie's hometown, and I do think that they were a little separate for a while there. I don't think they were necessarily close through the 80s and 90s. But Wildstein got back into politics about the same time Christie did. Christie became U.S. attorney in the early 2000s of New Jersey, and Wildstein started blogging. He started writing this like insider's political blog and was known to often write about this up and coming politician in the U.S. attorney's office. And he would sometimes get some scoops.
Let's just remind people what, yeah. What were, you know, obviously U.S. attorney's office is an office of prosecutors. What were, Christie's credentials, to get a job at essentially sort of the, Justice Department affiliate, let's call it, in New Jersey?
Well, on paper, his credentials were that he was a lawyer. He was also a lobbyist, but he had no criminal law experience. But what he did have was a relationship with the Bush world. He had raised money for the Bush 43's presidential campaign in 1999, actually went down to Austin, met Karl Rove, and he had that connection. And he also, at the time, had his eye on getting this gig, getting this appointment. His brother was also raising money for Bush, and they were working it. This is the gig that they wanted. Christie was getting support from local officials in New Jersey, trying to get letters of recommendation sent to Karl Rove's office, and it worked. Whatever wheels he was able to grease worked. He got the call, as he tells it, on September 10th, 2001. That he would be nominated to be U.S. attorney. And there was a lot of opposition because nobody thought many people in the bar in New Jersey did not think he was qualified for the gig.
And we should say that within 4 or 5 years, there was a massive scandal about the politicization of these U.S. attorneys. I'm telling this for the young people who work in this office, that there were three or four or five U.S. attorneys who were fired after George Bush was reelected, and which was very uncommon. And there was, at the very least, a significant amount of reporting that these U.S. attorneys were being pressured by Karl Rove to pursue politically motivated prosecutions that range from going after trial lawyers to going after sort of Democratic politicians and sources of funding around the country. And I say that because Chris Christie was fairly aggressive in going after public corruption, which is something that we all want. But mm-hmm. Give me a sense of just his time in office. This audience is pretty familiar with the Fort Dix Five case, which I guess is now on appeal. He touts it, but as far as I can tell, based on the reporting, it's a despicable miscarriage of justice. But I will save you from having to editorialize on that. But what else during his career stuck out as a U.S. attorney?
His primary focus was on public corruption. He went after about 130 politicians were indicted of both parties, including some major Republicans, which has been viewed cynically that he was, you know, clearing the deck so he could be the top dog Republican in the state. But the most curious incident involving public corruption while he was U.S. attorney was about 2 months before a U.S. Senate election. This, I believe, was 2004, when the balance of the Senate was at stake nationally. And there was a leak that indicated that Democratic U.S. Senator Bob Menendez of New Jersey was under investigation by his office. And there were like 4 or 5 sources that the reporters at the Star Ledger in New Jersey used in order to say this investigation was happening. And
that's a big leak.
Never got charged with anything. But it was a major issue in the election, and Menendez eventually won, but it raised a lot of eyebrows. And incidentally, the person Menendez was running against was the son of the guy that Christie went to the political rally with in 1977, or political rally for in 1977 with David Wildstein. It was Tom Kane Jr., the son of former Governor Tom Kane Jr., whom Christie had seen as his political mentor and whom he had rallied for in 1977 with David Wildstein. So it all kind of comes together.
I guess that's the way it works in New Jersey. So, So take us up to today. You've got this. Trial yep. going on. What are the charges of these two aides, and what are they saying in terms of what Christie knew?
They've been charged with various federal crimes related to conspiracy and other crimes related to closing a public roadway for political and corrupt purposes. Two people have been charged. There's the former deputy chief of staff to the governor, Bridget Ann Kelly, and his top staff appointee at the Port Authority, the agency that oversees the bridge, whose name is Bill Baroni. And the person who pleaded guilty was Bill Baroni's number two. That's David Wildstein, and he's expected to testify against the other two. Now, Bridget Ann Kelly, the deputy chief of staff, is the one who wrote the famous email that blew this whole scandal open, and that was time for some traffic problems in Fort Lee. Fort Lee was the town at the base of the bridge that suffered the traffic jam after the lanes in Fort Lee were shut down out of nowhere on the first day of school in September 2013. So the trial is now scheduled for May, and it is in federal court in Newark. And they both could face jail time, and they're both going to do what they can to get out of it. And it seems like the most obvious way to get out of it is to say that they were, you know, didn't know that there was anything untoward here. They were just following orders, as they say.
And we should, I guess, the reason why this is we're seeing a federal U.S. attorney bring this case as opposed to, let's say, a state AG would be because the bridge is partially managed by the state of New Jersey and partially managed by the state of New York, and therefore by crossing state lines it becomes a federal issue. So that is that narrow case of Bridgegate. Subsequent to the investigations that were going on, David Sampson, who was a one-time attorney general in the state of New Jersey, who became a very close confidant of Chris Christie's and was the director of the Port Authority, has had to resign, in part, at the very least, for sort of, I guess, prodding a major U.S. airline to set up a route to where he had a summer home or a weekend home, which you got to, you know, appreciate at least the balls that it takes to do something like that. But tell us about David Sampson, who's also sort of was a lawyer whose firm got a lot of business from companies hoping that the Port Authority would make decisions which would enhance their properties. Where does Sampson come into play into this? What is he being investigated, and who is the body investigating him?
Also, the U.S. Attorney's Office, and you did a great job summarizing it. I mean, he's essentially being looked at for a variety of potential crimes that have been uncovered by the press in New York and New Jersey related to, you know, benefiting himself through business to his law firm. By voting on things and pushing things in his capacity as the chairman of the Port Authority. Now, this job as chairman of the Port Authority there's nothing similar to it in the country. It is a massive gig. The budget is for the Port Authority is bigger than half of the states in the country. They operate LaGuardia Airport, Newark Airport, Kennedy Airport, George Washington Bridge is the busiest bridge in the world, the tunnels and bridges all over the New York metropolitan area. There's a lot of contracts, There's a lot of legal work. There's a lot of construction. These are powerful. This is a powerful, powerful entity. And the there's all kinds of conflict of interest things that they're looking at. But the most shocking is this thing where he shook down this allegation that at this fancy dinner in New York City, he's sitting with the chief executives of United Airlines, and he basically mandates or demands a quid pro quo, that if they want their fees lowered, because they pay these fees to be at the airports, if they want their fees lowered, then they're going to create a new flight that goes to South Carolina. And that's because his vacation home is in South Carolina, and there's no good flights out of Newark to South Carolina. So they created this flight. This is the allegation. They created this flight, and then nobody was on it because it was like a money loser. And not only that, it left on Thursday nights and came back on Sundays. Perfect for a weekend getaway. The day after, and this
4-day work week. That's not bad either.
Yeah, not bad, right? True. The most damning piece of evidence is that they canceled the flight the day after Sampson resigned at the Port Authority.
They could have been a little more subtle about that. And they also, my understanding is that it was nicknamed the Chairman's Flight.
That's what they called it. Yeah. And the by the way, the CEO of United Airlines has resigned in the wake of this. So there, and so has the, it's deeper and deeper. The lobbyist that Sampson was using is sort of, or the lobbyist for United Airlines that was sort of the go-between allegedly in this deal, then became Christie's transportation commissioner, and he has also since resigned. There's a handful of people who seem to be in the mix in New Jersey with all kinds of alleged shenanigans, and Sampson has been at the top of that list for some time. So
now, do you know what the status is? In other words, is Sampson cooperating with federal investigators? Is he sitting around, sort of sitting with his attorney, saying like, "Look, I'm in my 70s. I guess he's in his 70s now. Is there any way we can punt and see if I'm hanging around? I mean, they're not going to put an 85-year-old guy in jail. I don't want to turn on my friends if I have the opportunity to do that." I mean, what is the status right now?
We don't know. I wish I knew. I mean, if he is cooperating, that would be something else, because he is very close to the governor. They are almost basically best friends. Sampson was the head of Christie's transition team. He served a sort of kitchen cabinet role for Christie as an advisor. They talked constantly. They were, you know, he did all his debate prep when he first ran for governor with Sampson. I mean, they've gone back many years. If there are bodies buried, metaphorically, by the way, if there are bodies buried in New Jersey that Christie has something to do with, Sampson would know about it. So you do wonder if he's cooperating. You also wonder if Fishman, who is an Obama appointee, is waiting on further indictments to see how the presidential race shakes out. But, I mean, what if Christie was a nominee? I mean, then there's an indictment waiting. Does he wait for the indictment to issue an indictment during a general election or after Christie becomes president? You know, it all intertwines now with presidential politics.
Well, this has been my theory for a while, and I might as well just lay those cards on the table, that Chris Christie is running as hard as he can away from these indictments, potential indictments, as he is towards the presidency, that the longer he stays in the race, the more time he has, I guess, or that at the very least the race becomes a leverage point, right? I mean, when they knock on that door, and if he's third, or you know, if he's third behind Cruz and Trump, he's at least got some type of chit. Like, how about you just let me resign from the race and maybe let's negotiate something here? So
interesting.
Let me ask you this. Is Fishman the only one who's investigating these things now? Because it seems to me we have the Bridgegate, and so there's the potential that Barone and Kelly or one of them decide You know what? I'm ready to give up the governor, and they decide that on April 29th or whatever it is, a couple of days. Mm-hmm. Or Samson at one point says, "Hey, you know what? I don't want to end my life in prison. We're good friends, but we're not that good of friends." There also seems to me to be other ancillary. I mean, the Samson thing seems to me that it could go on for forever. There seems to be multiple different things they could be investigating. Is the New York Southern District U.S. attorney, are they still investigating it all, or have they more or less stepped aside? Because they have jurisdiction because it was the Port Authority.
I believe they've stepped aside, but the Manhattan District Attorney was involved, I mean, in some of this Port Authority stuff also. And they could still be have a role here. And there's also yet another investigation involving the Security and Exchange Commission over whether the Port Authority was funding projects in New Jersey that were not related to its mission. And there's complicated potential financial violations involved there. And as far as we know, that investigation was still ongoing, too. There's a lot of threads to be pulled. And there are other entities, but I think at this point it's just the Manhattan DA and the SEC.
Okay, there are two other questions I have for you, because as far as I can tell, there's if there are people who know more about this stuff than you, I don't know who they are. but at one point, it was reported that Governor Christie, and I think maybe this came up during the New Jersey State Assembly's investigation, that Christie called Governor Cuomo and said, "Tell your guy," and I guess it was Foy. Maybe it was Patrick Foy. I can't remember the guy's name, but he was the head of the New York side of the Port Authority, and he was basically saying, like, "No, everything that Christie is saying about this thing, we had no idea, we didn't know about it." Christie calls Cuomo and says, "Tell Patrick Foy to shut up." To what extent do we know anything more about that conversation? Was that just basically Cuomo just sort of saying, like, we'll leak this in some way, and just as a reminder to Christie that, like, maybe you don't want to put any money behind any campaign against me, even though you're the head of the Republican Governors Association? I mean, what about that dynamic?
They have a very interesting relationship, and they've really avoided going after each other in public. I mean, Cuomo never even criticized Christie for this lame thing that, you know, involved his own state. But this has been reported by two places that there's conversation between Christie and Cuomo happened. And it was Foy is the guy, I remember, who reopened the lanes once he found out this was happening. I mean, he was the top New York guy at the Port Authority. He finds out this is happening, he orders the lanes reopened. And then there's chatter that Samson was going to retaliate against Foy for reopening the lanes. And it was months later when Foy testified to that effect before the New Jersey legislature that this phone call between Christie and Cuomo happened. I don't know why this leaked out there. So far, publicly, there has been very little space between Cuomo and Christie. Christie could have gone after him when Cuomo ran for re-election. Christie was the Republican Governors Association chairman. He stayed out of that. Stayed out of that race, which got him some criticism from Republicans.
That Christie not putting money into that race, maybe it didn't look this way 6 months beforehand, but people should recall that Zephyr Teachout took a big chunk out of Cuomo, and I don't think that Cuomo's victory was necessarily endangered. But if this county supervisor from Rockland County, I can't remember his name now, who ran for
Astorino.
Yeah. Astorino gets another 5 or 10%. I mean, Cuomo's embarrassed at that point. And so that could have had, you know, if Chris Christie wanted to take a piece out of Cuomo, he could have done that. It seems to me. I mean, not necessarily defeat him, but certainly embarrass him more.
I think these guys, kind of like each other. They have Italian meals on at restaurants on both sides of the Hudson River. They are from a similar generation. They're similar demographically. They're both, political artists. They are political tacticians. I think they have respect for each other, and I think they have political deals in one way or another that has really dictated the nature of this relationship. It's been curious, to say the least.
Yeah, indeed. All right. Well, there's one. There's two things I want to ask you. One more. Well, during this is my sort of favorite. I don't know if it's my favorite part of this, but during the time that Patrick Foy was testifying before the legislature, apparently Christie got text messages. I can't remember if the story is he got text messages from a staffer and then deleted them, or actually deleted them during the testimony. Can you straighten that out for us? And how does Chris Christie justify deleting text messages from his staffers in the course of an investigation?
He said his phone was full, but said that.
Yeah, what do you save? What do you save when you delete a text message? Like 1 kilobyte? He had one of those 2 megabyte. He had one of those 2 megabyte storage phones.
Yeah,
those early Blackberries that you only could store 2 megabytes on it.
He had a lot of Springsteen on his phone, maybe. So
right.
He needed to make room. This was an exchange between an incoming chief of staff, and it was sent during testimony about Bridgegate. But there was technically not a federal investigation going on. It was just, at that point, a legislative investigation, a serious legislative investigation. They had subpoena power, but there was no criminal investigation going on, and that is how he can justify deleting this text exchange. He says he doesn't remember what they were talking about. The incoming chief of staff, who was on the receiving end of the messages and was also sending messages herself, said she thinks one of the messages was just talking about how the people testifying were acting professionally.
Right. Well, if he doesn't remember, it must have been very important.
I mean, this is what's prompted me to get into it with him about it, about this issue at press conferences a couple of times, because he's gone after Hillary Clinton on the stump for deleting her emails or having her own secret email server, whereas, his electronic communication has been really hard to come by. I've tried to bring that up with him, but haven't gotten very far.
Well, Matt, he already said it wasn't important stuff.
Yeah, that's true.
All right. Lastly, and I don't want to put you in an uncomfortable situation, but you can just say you never heard anything about it, because you're a professional reporter. You do not trade in idle rumor like someone like myself who does. Has anybody ever spent any time? Is there anything written about Chris Christie's relationship with a woman who worked in the U.S. Attorney's office under his time, who was then appointed to a New Jersey agency that builds bridges? Because I know that Christie got in trouble for, what was it, the King of Jordan put him up for $40,000? Okay, so the agency, there's a New Jersey agency that plans those trips. And my understanding is that he had someone he really must have appreciated at the U.S. Attorney's office. I can't remember her name right now. But appointed her to head this agency. And, of course, as part of that, head of that agency, would travel on those things. Has anybody dug around any of that stuff? Or am I just...
this woman, her name is Michelle Brown. He had given her, she first came to the fore during his first gubernatorial campaign because he had given her a loan reported. And then she got a couple of high powered gigs in New Jersey, including running this agency that uses, it's sort of a public private partnership that uses corporate money to fund a program that sells New Jersey to the rest, to other corporations around the country and around the world. So through this organization, it's called Choose New Jersey, he was able to take some big international trips using that money. And she runs the agency and makes, I think, $400,000, $500,000. It's a very large, it's kind of the best gig you can get in New Jersey other than being the coach of the Rutgers football team. There have been questions about the nature of that relationship because of the fact that they are close friends, and he had given her a loan, and now she has a high-powered gig that indirectly is involved with funding his travel. There's been digging on that, but I've never found anything illicit or otherwise untoward. It's just one of these.
Well, to be fair, if you're going to give somebody a loan, you want to be able to get them a good paying job so they can pay you back.
That's a good point. So you're saying he's fiscally prudent.
That's right. I'm saying he's got forethought, I should say.
Yes.
Well, Matt, I really appreciate your coming on and telling us about this. I think Christie's going to be around for as long as he can stay around, I think, because I definitely think that's part of a negotiation. You raise a good point. It's very difficult, I think. It's one thing for a U.S. attorney to charge, a sitting state senator with something. It's another when you get involved in a campaign. So I think Chris Christie is going to have to exit the presidential race before we get a real sense of just what kind of legal jeopardy he may or may not be in. But it's all in there. American Governor Chris Christie's Bridge to Redemption by Matt Katz. Matt, thank you so much for your time today. We'll put a link to the book at majority.fm.
Awesome, Sam. Thanks. I enjoyed it.
All right, folks, we're going to take a quick break and head into the fun half of the program. Although I got to say, part of this program was also fun. The Chris Christie stuff.
That
I really enjoyed.
Really does something for you.
And I have to say, I think Matt handled that very well. A lot of journalists don't want to, you're a straight reporter. Your stock and trade is you deal with only stuff that there is sort of like clear evidence of. And
are you talking about Chris Christie and his bro?
Well, his female bro.
His female bro. His bro. Yeah.
I mean, look.
Brosophy.
How many of us have not loaned significant amount of money to women who work in our office?
I'm just feeling like there'd be such a good...
Wait, now, wait a second. Kelly, you raising your hand? Are you looking for a loan?
No, I was just raising
do
my
you
hand
need
that
$50,000?
I have not.
Was
yes,
it, is
I
that
do.
How much his
Thank
loan
you.
Was? I think the loan was for at least... And I think it's interest-free.
That's great. That's
I'm
like
sure Nikki will be happy with
dad.
That. I'm sure that won't be a problem.
Thank you. Yeah. Right.
Sweetheart, our cash flow's a little bit off this month because I loaned Kelly $50,000.
Well, Chrissy was like, just use the
but don't
state
worry,
credit card.
I'm going to impose, I'm going to appoint her to a job where she's going to be making three times what I'm making, and then she'll be able to pay us back. Is there a problem, sweetheart? What are you doing with that pan?
She's like, who's Kelly? What are you talking about?
Wait, you have people who work for you?
Yeah.
That's exactly what would happen. Like, wait a second. You have people who work at your office? Yeah, and they've been there for a while.
The problem's
and
deeper
I loan
than
them
I
50
thought.
Grand every right. once in a while.
Yeah, of course. I can't wait. I can't wait to Chris. I guess, gosh. I mean, there's times you get distracted. You get distracted by Donald Trump. You get distracted by Ted Cruz. And I forget how much animosity I have towards Chris Christie. How much I'm enjoying him. Watching him run around New Hampshire. Get New Jersey to hate him. Take Pete Peterson's money so that he can stay in the race a little bit. Because I think Pete Peterson is going to, I think they're going to continue to pay him. I mean, as long as he keeps singing about cutting Social Security and he's on the debate stage, I think he'll stay in. And then I don't know what his plan is. I mean, I guess it's just to wait and hope that David Sampson has a heart attack. Right? I mean, David Sampson passes away, he's probably in the clear.
Try to get a boat.
David Sampson dies, you'll hear that.
I thought you were going to play some like Bruce song. All right, folks, we're going to take a quick break. Hey, just a reminder, this show.
Remember who we said needed to cuff him?
What's that? Who was going to cut? Oh, we're going to Bruce. Yeah. They'll deputize Bruce Springsteen.
Just to cut, like, excuse me, Mr. Governor. Have Chris like a Christie, song ready for it.
Great to see you. Put your hands behind your back, please. You have the right to remain silent. Anything you use can be used, anything you say can be used against you in the court of law. Little Stevie will put the shackles on you.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah. The whole E Street reunion just to arrest him. Awesome.
Yeah, this is a really weird Bruce song to be playing.
This is when Bruce goes off Nebraska? This is when he goes to arrest Christie.
I see. All right. folks, it is your membership that make this show possible. Without you joining this program, I will not be able to finance the many loans that I am prepared to offer people in this office. Oh, God. JoinTheMajorityReport.com. Also, if you buy coffee, you should be buying it from JustCoffee.coop. They have many different types of coffee. It is all fair trade. And with the coupon code Majority, you get 10% off. They ship it right to your door. Free shipping. Make no mistake, ladies and gentlemen, JustCoffee.coop has the coffee you want. And I promise you, we're going to make those coupons so you can give it to somebody as a gift. So what you do is you buy them the Majority Report blend, then you print out the coupon. You give them the coupon. You say, here's the Majority Report blend. Here's a 10% coupon that I paid for in advance for you. Winkety wink. I mean, this whole theme of today's show is about how you give gifts and you don't actually pay for them. And there you have it. And also, if you buy crap from Amazon, buy it through our link at majorityreportkickback.com. But you don't want to buy from Amazon. You want to try out jet.com. It's a great service. We just bought a book. Who just bought a book there? Did you just buy a book from there? Did you just buy a book? Somebody just told me they bought a book from jet.com. Maybe I had a dream about it. But you can go through our link at majorityreportkickback.com to jet.com, and we get a kickback. You notice no difference. All right. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we got plenty of sound. Some unbelievable a-hole. The guy who actually got paid by all the privatization of the democracy in Michigan. The way that he reacts to this whole Flint, Michigan thing, the way that both of them on Fox, it's disgusting. It's disgusting. It's disgusting. Take a quick break. We'll be right back. 646-257-3920 is the number. See you in a minute.